Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to the Ken Hudson Show. Ken has investigated the strange and unusual for over two decades. He's led ghost tours, and he's accessed the most haunted places in the Southwest. He's the author of some 40 books of the paranormal, unusual, hidden treasure, conspiracies, and the downright strange. His personal experiences and the experiences of many others are related on this show and in his many books. Please sit back, relax, and enjoy as Ken takes us through tales of terror, trauma, and triumph. And now, your host, Mr. Ken.
And good evening. You're listening to Ken Hudnall. This is the Ken Hudnall Show right here on the one and only Blog Talk Radio, coming to you live from our studios in El Paso, Texas, gateway to the Old West and the most haunted city in the country. Now, my guest tonight, I don't know what's wrong with our studio light. It seems to be flickering somewhat. My guest tonight is Bernard Heisch, Ph.D. He is an astrophysicist, editor, author of several books. We're going to be talking to him about the purpose-guided universe, believing in Einstein, Darwin, and God, which is an interesting combination in anybody's book. But we're going to be talking not only about that, but we're going to be talking about a number of other topics. You know, when we have the opportunity to have guests of Dr. Heisch's caliber, it's always a rare opportunity for many of our listeners who really are struggling, as they've said to me, and what and how to believe about the creation of the universe. Was it accidental? Was it designed by some intelligence? Well, we have one of a very learned individual with us tonight. We'll pick his brain. Then the second and third hours, I'm going to be talking about a number of topics, answering emails, as it were, because I'm always getting emails asking questions that can't be answered in just a few lines and are better answered here. So with all that said, I'm going to bring on our guest, and we're going to get the show started. This hour is brought to you by Marcello's Ristorante Italiano. Two locations, 1360 Lee Trevino and 5380 North Mesa. Now, for those of you in this area, this is one of our local sponsors. We are adding some national sponsors in the very near future, and we will be having some of their products to give away. Right now, I have a $25 gift coupon, which basically is enough for dinner for two at this outstanding Italian restaurant. They've got every type of food you can imagine, from pasta to vegetarian plates, fish, chicken, veal, lamb. It's like stepping back into old Italy. So, appreciate if you will spend time with our advertisers. Dr. Heisch?
Yes, hello, good evening.
How are you?
Doing just fine. How about you?
Oh, considering it's 97 degrees right now, I'm doing pretty good.
Well, I hope you're in an air-conditioned room.
I am that. Otherwise, I think my computers would give up the ghost.
Right.
It's been as high as 105 this week, so I guess 97 is like a breath of fresh air. Now, you wrote a very interesting book, The Purpose-Guided Universe, Believing in Einstein, Darwin, and God, and that is a unique combination to believe in.
It is, and I want to make clear at the outset that what I've written about is not at all intelligent design. It's very different. But what I'm proposing is that there is an intelligence behind the universe, behind the creation of the universe and the Big Bang. But also, as we'll discover as we talk this evening, that the evolution, the process of evolution, is a key process and what I think is the purpose behind all of this. So, yeah, it's an unusual combination, but I think it's an unusual book in that it gives people the opportunity to sort of put science into perspective. Say, yeah, science is great, it does wonderful things, but that does not rule out an intelligence behind the universe. In fact, I think it argues for it.
Well, now, scientists that I had is, or those who call themselves scientists, who are my professors, would be spinning in their graves at the very idea that there was any type of intelligence. So what are you talking about when you talk about intelligence?
Well, the reason I talk about intelligence at all is that there have been a number of discoveries in physics and astrophysics over the last, say, 20 years that show that there are a number of properties of the universe that are really pretty special for the formation of life. There are at least 10 critical properties that I can think of that I list in my book that could have been very different than they are, and yet the fact that they lie within certain ranges makes it possible for stars to exist, for planets to form around stars, and then ultimately for life to arise on the surfaces of those planets and to evolve into various creatures. And so these critical properties of the universe, I think, have changed the perspective a lot on what it means to talk about the origin of the universe and why it's here.
Mm-hmm. And these things, these properties, could just as easily have been something else. Would it not have allowed life to be as readily created? If I'm understanding
you. Exactly. And there have been two explanations for that. Two equally rational explanations for this. The one that you'll find in mainstream science is that if our universe looks to be special, that's got to imply that there must be many other universes out there that are radically different from ours. And we exist in this one because we couldn't live in any other. So the very fact that ours seems special implies that there are lots and lots of others. And in fact, the number that's tossed around in physics circles, that there must be 10 to the 500th power other universes. And that means one followed by 500 zeros. That's an enormous number of other universes to posit just to explain away why ours looks special but isn't really. The alternative that I'll talk about tonight, and my preference, is that, well, if a universe looks special, it's because it is special. And it's because there's intelligence behind the creation of it. But that intelligence is behind the creation of the Big Bang, not behind the creation of life forms individually, the way that is proposed in intelligent design. It's a very different thing.
Well, I know in science a lot of things start out as a hypothesis. And then you hopefully find empirical evidence and arrive at an answer, if you will. Well, what do you base this theory on?
Well, if you look at the two theories next to each other, the real hard evidence for both is absolutely zero. There's no evidence that there are an infinite number of other universes or even a huge number to explain things in terms of the mainstream physics interpretation, that ours only looks special, but it's just part of a huge ensemble that's statistically all randomly distributed. There's zero evidence for that. There's also zero hard evidence for the existence of an intelligence behind the universe, but there is evidence that I think is worth considering, and that involves the transcendent and mystical experiences of people throughout the ages. People have actually seen the purpose behind the universe and the intelligence behind it. And you can dismiss this as simply mental hallucinations or even coaxes, I suppose. But it's been a constant throughout history that people have experienced this. And I think it's foolish for us to throw the evidence away, especially when there is congruence between what different people have seen over different cultures and different time periods. I think that's not hard evidence of the sort you'd like to have in a physics laboratory, but it certainly is circumstantial evidence.
Well, true, and one of the worst arguments I ever got in was with a professor about Darwin's theory of evolution. I am always amused that when you ask a question of a religious leader that they can't answer, they say you just have to have faith. And when I ask questions about details of Darwin's theory of evolution, in effect, because of the missing link, I was being told just to have faith. You're right, there's no evidence on either side for anything. It literally boils down to having faith, at least in my humble opinion.
Well, ultimately, there's sort of a matter of faith on both sides, but there is quite a bit of evidence on the side of science for lots of things. You know, the fact that we're talking right now on the internet, the fact that when I drove home tonight, my car ran, that there are planes that fly through the sky. These things certainly show that science is correct. I mean, it's got a correct explanation of the physical world. The question is, there anything beyond the physical world? Is there anything that perhaps at the basis of our physical world that was not physical to begin with, like an intelligence? Those are the tough questions for which there's really no hard evidence, but the evidence for the workings of science are abundant, so I don't want to disparage that at all. I'm a scientist myself. I really appreciate what science has done over the last, say, 350 years. But that doesn't mean that science has the ultimate answers to things. In fact, the answers to the question of the origin of the universe, that really does lie outside of the realm of science.
Well, you're absolutely right. I guess I will have to ask, theoretically, when you're looking at answering the questions about the intelligence, if there's no evidence either way, what can you even base the theory on that doesn't come out to be science fiction?
I said that the hard evidence on both sides was zero. Hard evidence meaning the kind of evidence you'd find to accept a theory like the theory of relativity or quantum mechanics. That hard evidence is not there on either side, but there is circumstantial evidence. And since we have to try to make some sense out of what's going on, I'm proposing that circumstantial evidence be taken seriously. Now, I'm not going to say that you have to. I mean, I'm the first to say, look, logically, you can accept either explanation. You can accept that our universe is not special at all. It's just part of a huge set of universes, all of which are different from each other, and that's why ours appears special, because we couldn't be in any of those others. That's fine. Right. I accept the logic of that, 100%. Go with that if you want to. But it's irrational to say, well, it's not sensible to talk about a creator behind all of this. The universe may be special because that was how it was proposed to be, how it was designed to be. You can't argue that view is unsustainable. That's just as sustainable as the other one. And that's my point, that you have to make a choice, and that choice doesn't guarantee you that you're correct, but you do have to make a choice.
It's interesting. A bunch of folks in the chat room, and I just got a message that when I asked that question, the individual who sent me the private text said his computer immediately went down. Now, in theory, I suppose that could be evidence for something.
Well, probably evidence for a problem in the computer.
Well, there's always that, yes. Occam's Razor says that when you have a question along those lines, the most basic answer that takes into account all the factors is probably the most correct. There are a lot of factors that had to be just right for there to be life. And here, it all those things came together at one time in one place. But it's just like the guy who goes to the casino and he rolls a dozen sevens. Luck can have a part to play in it, can it?
It can. If you want to just view the whole thing as a process of luck, all right, you can do that. But I think even there's a problem, because ultimately you have to go back to the pre-existence of something. And if our universe really is a pointless vacuum fluctuation of some kind that came into existence because quantum fluctuations 14 billion years ago, you still have to ask, well, how is that even possible? Didn't there have to pre-exist something like quantum laws? I mean, even quantum fluctuations can't happen without quantum laws. So you're stuck with something that's sort of the irreducible pre-existing thing that's always there. And that something can be quantum laws. I mean, maybe quantum laws are just there, just forever there, have no beginning, have no end. On the other hand, maybe there's an intelligence there that has no beginning and has no end. We just don't know. We're sort of stuck because we can only go back in logic so far before we come to the point where we have to accept something or other as the basis.
Well, that's an interesting point. Just out of curiosity, how would you even prove the existence of a, call it a supreme intelligence, whatever you may want to call it, how would you prove this intelligence exists?
I don't think you can scientifically, but I do think that you can prove it to yourself if you want to take the effort. And this takes us back to one of the things I discussed in my book, Purpose Designed Universe, that has to do with the perennial philosophy. The perennial philosophy is the name given to the compendium of, let's just call it wisdom, the compendium of wisdom that's at the basis of all the world's religions. All of them together pretty much have very similar views when you get below the dogma, below the surface differences. And there was a very brilliant book written by Aldous Huxley in 1945 that collected all of this information, the sayings of the mystics, the beliefs at the root of all religions. He called it, as well, the perennial philosophy. And that perennial philosophy says that there is an intelligence behind everything, and moreover, that we share that intelligence. One of the great truths in that philosophy is that it says, thou art that. And by thou, it means you and I, human beings. And mm-hmm. That is a great intelligence. And it's saying that our own intelligence, our own consciousness, is really the same as that of an intelligence that made the universe. And so if you want evidence, it's not going to be scientific evidence. It's not going to be the kind of evidence that you find in the laboratory or even in the court of law. But you're liable to find the evidence for an intelligence by looking inside yourself. Because inside yourself is where you discover the true consciousness that's the very same consciousness, according to the traditions, as that that made the universe.
I remember reading something by Huxley years ago that that talked about that topic. It's just been so long, I don't remember all the details. He had a unique outlook. Now, one of the people in the chat room, the Lone Ghostman, said J.B. Bank did a study on this back in the 30s. Sorry, Ryan. It seems to be a question that a lot of people come to at some point in their career. It's almost like, in some respects, we're kind of programmed to look at that.
Programmed to look at what?
We're kind of programmed to look at that topic.
Oh, to ask the ultimate question, yes, of course, because when we all want purpose in our lives, everybody wants a purpose. And the question is there a grand purpose in each of our lives? Or is the best we can do to have sort of transient purposes, like having a good marriage, having good kids, having a great career? You know, those are purposes, and they're not bad purposes. They're good purposes, but they're transient. They disappear when you die. The question is there an ultimate purpose, not just for us individually, for the entire universe? And I suggest that there is, and I suggest that purpose has to do with an intelligence behind the universe wanting something. Now, wanting something is something that we and other living creatures provide.
I'm wondering, will we ever be able to determine the existence of this intelligence?
We may be able to indirectly, because I'm hypothesizing, and this is heretical, so let me go ahead and say that at the outset, that it's not the case that somehow in the brain as a result of brain chemistry and neurophysiology and all this other stuff that's going on chemically. It's not that somehow consciousness arises out of that. It's really quite the opposite, that consciousness is the basis of reality, that consciousness is the stuff that sort of created matter and energy together. And that's a view that is quite the opposite from mainstream physical science. But I think it's a view that's going to become more seriously considered in this century as we begin to explore areas beyond physics that are now taking center stage as the primary sources of research, namely biology.
Mm-hmm.
Going back to something that was said by one of the great astrophysicists of the last century, Sir James Jeans, who worked in the early part of the 20th century in England, he wrote, "The universe begins to look more like a great thought than like a great machine." That to me really summarizes my perspective on things, that the universe and its laws really do reflect the great thoughts of an intelligence rather than a mechanical machine that's consisting simply of matter and energy without any purpose.
Well, if the universe was created by an intelligence, it has to be vast, because look at all the laws that... Without these laws, there'd be total chaos and confusion. And we're learning new laws almost every day.
Well, it certainly is vast. I mean, the universe is tremendously vast. It's been around for almost 14 billion years. It's huge. It's a vast, vast thing. And so the intelligence that thought it up, in my view, must be vast as well. But I have no problem with that. I mean, who would want a creator that's not vast?
Yeah, certainly that's correct. I mean, there's areas we're only now beginning to know even exist, such as quantum physics.
Right, and interestingly, it's quantum physics that some of the best evidence is emerging today, that consciousness is really the seat of everything, that consciousness is really what creates reality. This is something that's been part of quantum physics since the very beginning, since the get-go in the 1920s. But there are new experiments that have been done in the last few years that really show that at the quantum level, it's consciousness that makes things happen. And that is important because the quantum level is the basis, the foundation. And if things, the foundation, ultimately are controlled by consciousness, then by implication, so are things at a higher level. So I think we'll probably discover in this century, this coming century, that things are, that we've been looking at things the wrong way, from the wrong direction. And we should pay much more attention to consciousness as a basis of reality.
So, who was it that said that existence is just a thought in time? I was reading that the other day and don't remember who wrote it.
I don't know. That sounds very similar to what I just quoted from
James Jeans.
Yes, it does.
Yeah. Yes, it does. Well, that would also bring into question the theory that time moves progressively.
Well, I don't know that it has any impact on that, because certainly time moving progressively is just part of the universe. But my view is that space came with the universe. That, in fact, I would say most physicists would probably say that that's correct, that space and time came into existence with the universe. So the fact that time marches along in the universe is not surprising. That's part of what the basis of the universe is all about. The question is, what is there that lies beyond the universe? And does space and time extend beyond the universe? And I think the answer to that is no. I think there, beyond the universe, there are other realities, probably, which, interestingly, is something that's coming both out of a spiritual tradition and out of string theory. In the string theory, physicists are now investigating other dimensions, many other dimensions that might exist, and even considering the possibility of other parallel universes in what they call the bulk. So the idea that there is more out there than the physical universe is something that both the mystics and the string theorists would probably agree on if they weren't just so hung up on semantics.
Well, they certainly are hung up on semantics. Now, just for as simply as possible, could you run over what string theory is?
Yeah, that's a tough one because, you know, string theory is really, really complex and abstract. In fact, it's been called more of an exercise in theoretical mathematics than physics. There are about 1,500 string theorists worldwide that spend all their time writing string theory papers and thinking deep mathematical thoughts. And the fact of the matter is, I don't think, unless you're one of those highly trained people, you can understand string theory. If you're an ordinary physicist or an astrophysicist, you can understand it at a qualitative level, but the stuff is really, really complex. And it's not clear that it has any bearing, any relationship to reality, other than the possibility that somehow gravity is linked to the other three forces. That's sort of the one shining thing in string theory that draws people to it. But in a nutshell, string theory proposes that all the particles that we know, all the fundamental particles like electrons and muons and quarks and so on, neutrinos, that all these particles are really just the same thing vibrating differently, the same thing being a string. But the string is so tiny in theory, it's like it's compared to the atom, or put it this way, comparing a string to an atom, it's like comparing an atom to the solar system. So there's no hope whatsoever of actually creating a string or studying its properties in the laboratory. So it's all a mathematical kind of game at this point, with the hope that somehow it'll result in something that can be testable. But at the moment, it's beyond testing.
Well, there's certainly a number of paths that people are going down, and there's been more. I think there's probably been more schools of thought come into existence since right before World War II than existed part of that time. So how could we have so many new schools of thought? Is it the fact we there are more things being created all the time, or the fact that we've just now realized there's more things out there than what we were familiar with?
I think it's the realizing that there's more out there. But, you know, what I'm talking about in terms of my basis for thinking there's an intelligence, that's really not new at all. I mean, this is probably the oldest information in the world, literally the oldest information in the world, because it goes back to traditions that are thousands of years old. And the perennial philosophy is based upon ideas that have been around for at least 4,000 years or so.
Mm-hmm.
So what I'm proposing is a new wrinkle, sort of a redressing in 21st century clothing, something that's been around for centuries and centuries. And that, by the way, that's a good thing. That's not a bad thing, because if I were proposing something brand new, you'd be right to be skeptical. I mean, who am I to make up a new theory of who God is and what the purpose of the universe is? I'm not. I'm simply collecting from ancient wisdom some of these ideas and putting them in a modern context.
Well, true. What I find so fascinating is the fact that no matter where you're at in history, we're pretty much asking the same questions, just as you say, in different context.
It is the oldest question that mankind faces, which is, what is our nature? What is our origin? We have really good explanations for the physical part of all this now. Yeah, you know, we know how old the universe is. It's 13.7 billion years old. We know how old the Earth is. It's 4.6 billion years old. We know how life forms evolved. Well, they evolved through evolution. We know a lot of things, and we have machines to prove that our knowledge is correct. But yet we don't know the ultimate purpose of it all, nor do we even know whether this all came into existence out of some random fluctuation that was birthed by pre-existing quantum laws, God knows where they came from, or whether this is part of an intelligence that also pre-existed. So the fundamental question is still there after all these centuries, but I think that the answer is also there if we look carefully at the traditions that underlie that knowledge.
But do we really want to know the answer? For example, what if we determine that it was all just a big accident?
Well, that would be very demoralizing.
Yes, it would. And then if we determine that, no, there was a purpose, then that is presupposing the existence of an entity of tremendous power. And I think, in actuality, to many, that would be demoralizing as well, wouldn't it?
Well, I don't think so, once you understand the relationship between that entity and us. Once you understand that and realize, going back to the thou art that, really, we are that entity. That entity is no stranger. One of the people in my book who had a mystical experience wrote about how he yearned and yearned to seek oneness with the divine, with God. And he spent years as a hermit living up in the Santa Cruz Mountains and meditating and doing all the things that he thought would finally induce an experience. And one day he had it. It came to him one night, a mystical experience that opened up the universe to him for a few minutes, as it does to people. It basically opens up the universe within, and one can sort of see all at once and all of time, in a very short time, all of time. It's just an amazing thing that people report. And he did. It happened to him. And what he discovered was, while he was seeking God outside, when it actually happened, God was inside, because God has always been inside, because that is his nature. That was this person's nature, and that's your nature and my nature too. And so I think that the proof and the searching for evidence will be an internal one rather than an external one.
So it comes back to, you've got to have faith.
I don't think you have to have faith. I think that if you had such an experience, you'd realize this is not faith anymore. This is a real experience. Because the people that have these things, these experiences, report that this is the most real thing in their lives, that this is more real than reality. This is more real than 1 + 1 = 2. When they have it, they know the truth has finally come to them. And unfortunately, it doesn't persist. I mean, the memory persists. You recognize that something great happened to you. But the details of what this is all about that were crystal clear during that moment of insight, those unfortunately are gone, in part because we don't have the words or the concepts in the everyday world to keep these things alive, to even discuss them.
Yeah, that is a valid point. And everyone, when something like that happens, wants to tell others what they've discovered. And as you say, there's no way to prove it. It's an individual experience.
One of the experiences in my book was a young doctor named Alan Smith. He was watching a sunset over the San Francisco Bay one night, probably around 1970 or thereabouts, when he suddenly felt that there was an additional light, not just the light from the sunset, but some other light that was sort of surrounding him and growing in intensity. As it did so, he grew happier and happier until finally his happiness became joy, became ecstasy, became almost unbearable. Time began to stand still. Now, I don't know how time stands still, but that's what he experienced. And it was perhaps the most, it was definitely the most joyful experience he'd ever had, one that, in fact, 40 years later, he writes, is more real than anything else he's ever experienced. Now, he did something very interesting. He decided that he would like to compare this to a drug experience to see whether it was the same thing or whether it was simply some drug-induced event, even though he hadn't taken any drugs at that time.
Mm-hmm.
He took LSD. He found something similar, but it wasn't the same thing at all. In place of an experience that was uniquely and continuously pleasant, happy, ecstatic, he found his experience sort of oscillated between happiness and terror, and that the standing still of time never fully happened on the drug, and that the drug experience faded away over time, whereas the transcendent experience is one that you find as vivid today as you did 40 years ago. So there were significant differences between the real mystical transcendent experience and the LSD experience, and that's important to know.
Well, there are so many who believe that, for example, when LSD came out, a lot of folks jumped on it as the way to get closer to God. But for many, all it did was leaving with a feeling of, from what I've read, of complete and total frustration because it was not what they expected it to be. Now, go ahead.
I was just going to say, yes, I agree with that. And the experience of the doctor verifies that. It was a very different kind of experience.
Do you think we're programmed to search for God?
Depends on what you mean by program. If you use the word program in the sort of Richard Dawkins sense of, well, we're just machines, we're just algorithms mindlessly going about our business, then I would argue, no, that's a very poor way to look at our quest for God. But if program, by program, do you mean, do we have a propensity for it? Do because we're curious, because we want to know our own nature, because deep down inside, perhaps we still realize and remember that we are the same as God, and we want to explore that further. So if programmed is meant in that sense, then I'd say, yes, I agree with that.
Well, now, religion, in the broad sense, frankly, is nothing more than a control mechanism.
Oh, I agree with you. I think religions are a problem, a real problem. You go back through history and you find that religions have caused lots of wars, lots of conflicts. I mean, in the time around 1500, you had the Catholics hating the Protestants and the Protestants hating the Catholics. Nowadays, you've got the Shiites hating the Sunnis and the Sunnis hating the Shiites. It's not been a very pleasant situation. There's been a lot of division, a lot of hatred, a lot of murder that fostered the name of religion. So I really want to differentiate between spirituality, which is basically a recognition, an acknowledgement that there is more to reality than the physical universe, and that we ourselves are more than simply physical beings. That's spiritual. But religion, that comes with an awful lot of baggage. It comes with dogmas. It comes with money, power structures, belief demands. Even sometimes the most horrible things, the most horrible atrocities committed by one person against another in the name of religion.
That's
right.
You
don't blow up a market, you know, because somehow God told you that if you do this, become a suicide bomber, you'll go straight to heaven. That is insane. And that is a religion at its most pitifully worthless.
I agree. There's a question in the chat room. Do we have to die to find evidence of an afterlife?
I don't think so, because I think the near-death experiences have given lots of evidence that there is something that survives. It's something, not just some little thing, but that our essence survives. I think the near-death experiences are a great source of experiential evidence that there's more to reality than simply this physical cosmos.
Well, I've been on enough ghost hunts to know that whether you want to call it a ghost or whatever you want to call it, there's something there that does, when it takes a notion to, communicate, and it seems to be intelligent. And when, you know, energy is created, it can never be destroyed. It only changes form. So that argues at death for the creation of some entity. No longer living, but as we know, living, but certainly it the energy doesn't dissipate.
Yeah, probably not. We're getting into details that are beyond my ability to speak intelligently about it.
Well, the isn't a ride just that? It's a near death. I'm not sure what that refers to.
Is it what, like near death?
Isn't a ride just that? It's a near death.
Yeah.
And do we ever get evidence? And we do. There's been a lot of arguments that the near-death experience is just chemicals in the brain reacting to lack of oxygen.
That's easily dismissed, because there are many reports of people seeing things from a perspective that they couldn't have seen from their body. And so if you experience yourself rising to the top of the room and you see things from the ceiling that you couldn't possibly see lying in your bed, then that disproves that immediately. So that's just nonsense to claim that this is simply a product of chemistry. It's people who say that just haven't looked at the facts.
Or don't want to believe that some part exists after death.
Exactly. Exactly. It's convenient to ignore things if they don't fit into your world view, your frame of reference.
And those that argue for reincarnation, I don't think really stop to think just how many problems admitting there is reincarnation could cause.
Well, I think it would solve a lot of problems, too. In fact, I think it's probably the only solution to the problem of how can a benevolent intelligence allow things to happen, even to... And how can you justify having in the traditional paradigm, having sort of one shot at heaven, whether you die when you're 2 weeks old and you've never had to, quote, commit a sin, or whether you are a person who has been born into an existence that almost forces you to do evil, though no one's ever totally forced. I don't think there's any way to rectify a just and kind deity with the one life is all you get paradigm. So I think that living multiple lives is the only solution to that conundrum.
Well, of course, the very concept of sin, I think, is one of the most powerful control mechanisms that anybody could ever have come up with.
Yeah. By the way, let me just comment again on the last point I made, because in his book, The Demon-Haunted World, even Carl Sagan, a real skeptic, a brilliant man, but a real skeptic, wrote that there are three claims that, in his opinion, deserve serious study. Not that he believed them, but he thought they were serious enough that he wanted to study them. And claim number three was that, quote, this is out of Carl Sagan's book, that young children sometimes report the details of a previous life, which upon checking turn out to be accurate, which they could not have known about in any way other than reincarnation. Now, he says, I picked these claims not because I think they're likely to be valid, I don't, but as examples of contentions that might be true. So even Carl Sagan admitted the possibility that there was evidence for this, and I think the evidence he was referring to almost certainly was the work of Ian Stevenson, a professor at the University of Virginia, whom I knew pretty well, who spent 40 years investigating cases of children who remembered past lives. So it's in fact the one claim for which there's actually some substantial body of evidence.
Well, certainly the ones that I've read about, most of which come out of India, were very, very strong, as you say, was very strong evidence for reincarnation, especially the one young boy who recognized his wife, his children. And, I mean, how do you discount that?
I wouldn't want to discount that. I think that there's real evidence there.
Well, it certainly opens up quite a number of doors that I know many of traditional view wish would stay closed, especially the concept of reincarnation.
Yeah. And what sense does it make? Suppose this is correct, that we are actually incarnations of God living in a physical universe. Now, does it make any sense to be incarnating into a physical universe that's almost 14 billion years old for 80 years and calling it quits? I mean, if we're going to participate in this game of existing, of coming into existence as physical beings, then why would we do it only once? It just logically doesn't make any sense.
And that's a good point. And then the concept of heaven and hell. So many things, when you look at them closely, are just created by man. That doesn't mean that they're actually true.
Oh, yeah, exactly. The concept of hell was created by lots of people, but many of them were churchmen, because it helped to control the clients, control the population, have them believe that if they didn't follow your rules, and of course pay your stipends and other...
Right.
The donations of the church, you'd go straight to hell. And they had the power to keep you out of hell or send you to hell. And that's a pretty powerful claim. And no wonder they were able to keep the peasants in check.
Well, the one I liked the best, of course, was the Crusades. You were pardoned in advance for any sin you may commit in the name of God.
Yes, exactly.
Free tickets to heaven.
The Crusades, unfortunately, are sort of happening in reverse these days in terms of believing that you're going to go to heaven for doing slaughtering others.
That's quite true. 72 virgins just for going and blowing yourself up.
Isn't that crazy?
But as somebody pointed out, the promise didn't say, if you're a male suicide bomber, the promise didn't say that they were 72 female virgins.
Well, it served them right.
But we've done a lot of extremely crazy things in the name of religion. And yet, there are so many people that if the Pope said go jump off the bridge, probably would do it.
Yeah, I think, I'm afraid so. I had a little discussion the other night with someone. I was reading him a passage from Deuteronomy. It's from the Bible, Deuteronomy chapter 22, verse 13. Let me read that to you. It's a short little command of sorts, a commandment. It says, if a man discovers on his wedding night that his bride is not a virgin, he must stone her to death on her father's doorstep. Now, my comment on that was, this is not the word of God. I mean, if this were God, then I would not want to have anything to do with that nutcase that wrote this. So it's got to be the writings of a human being. But the host of the program I was discussing this on said, well, I didn't understand the context, and we should look at the verses before and afterwards and try and put it into perspective, et cetera, et cetera. And I said, baloney. This says very clearly, you're supposed to stone your bride to death. There's no ifs, ands, or buts about that. It's, you know, no sentence before, no sentence afterwards, and take that away, unless the second sentence said, well, just kidding, folks. You know, but it doesn't say that in the Bible. It doesn't say just kidding, folks. It actually says do it.
And that's right.
That is religion at its worst.
Well, religion has... Now, those who believe that they are, you know, approaching the holy by following everything the Bible says, more often than not, are some of the most narrow-minded people I've ever met.
Yeah. I don't want to condemn people wholeheartedly or wholesale, but... That is a problem.
They're busy condemning others, so turnabout's fair play.
Yep. Let me bring up an example from quantum mechanics of some of this role of consciousness.
By all means.
Let's talk about entanglement. That's a term that's used a lot in physics, and this is going to be a simple example. I'm going to have two human twins be, quote, entangled quantum mechanically, strictly as a brain exercise, of course.
Okay.
Let's assume I'm a teacher. I'm a teacher in school, and there are two twins in my class. Call them Joe and Jim. Now, Joe and Jim don't live together. They live on opposite sides of town, and they don't see each other or even talk to each other before they meet in my classroom. Okay, now, before they come, I've got four index cards that say shirt, shoes, socks, or pants. So before the twins arrive, I blindly choose one of the cards at random, and it says socks. Okay, when the twins arrive in class, I look at their socks. And sure enough, they're wearing the same color socks. Very interesting. Well, the next day, same thing happens, except this time I pull out the index card that says shirt. Well, the twins arrive in my class, and sure enough, the shirts are the same color shirts. They match. The same thing happens every single time. They have no way to communicate with each other. They're not telling each other what they're wearing, and yet I get to choose some item of apparel that they don't even know about. And when they arrive in my class, they'll have matching socks or shoes or pants or shirts, whichever I choose. I get to choose. They are forced, basically, to comply with my choice of which of their items of apparel are going to be coinciding. Well, this may seem like a far-fetched example, but this is exactly what happens in quantum experiments. You can entangle photons just the way the twins were entangled. You can choose to measure a property of one photon and the other, at random, basically. You can choose which direction to measure its spin in, for example. And the other photon is going to wind up with a correlated property. So the same situation applies in quantum physics as in the example I just showed. And there's no way to explain that in terms of the sort of physics of the large-scale world. You have to have consciousness and sort of a fluid reality that's being created by consciousness exist at the quantum level.
Now, I've been told that the mere act of observation can change the outcome of a quantum physics experiment. Is that correct?
That's correct. In fact, not change, but actually determine the outcome. For example, you can put an atom is both a wave and a particle. We know that in quantum physics. Its wave properties are sometimes called a wave function. But just think of it as a wave. Now, as a wave, it can be spread out over two boxes. So you can have one atom that in its wave state is spread out over two boxes. What is this crazy wave state? Well, it's just the atom spread out over two boxes. But if you look inside one of the boxes, your look is going to force that atom to either be in the box or be in the other box. And so your observation makes that wave function collapse and gives you an atom in one or the other boxes. It's really your looking at it that's going to make the difference between where it's going to be found. So your look makes it real. Your consciousness makes the atom real. Even Heisenberg recognizes this. Werner Heisenberg was one of the founders of quantum mechanics. And he wrote that the atoms or elementary particles are not real. They form a world of potentialities or possibilities rather than one of things or facts until you make the observation. So at the quantum level, things behave in a very suggestive way that consciousness is really what's calling the shots.
Well, that's certainly a... That can very easily give you a headache trying to...
I was going to call it a brain teaser.
Definitely that. Let's see. You can manifest aspects of how you get through the word. You can experience a charmed life if you understand how it works. Through the world. I find it interesting that in actuality, quantum physics or quantum mechanics or whatever you want to call it is so different from standard or the physics I learned in school.
It is. It's a very different logic. It's totally different. It's a different realm. But in fact, if the quantum effects take place as they do, then that implies that even though things look like they're operating in a different way at the large scale, it's kind of an illusion because the quantum laws are really the basis of everything. And they point to consciousness. So if the consciousness makes the atom appear in one box or the other, then ultimately the consciousness is also responsible for the chair I'm sitting in, although it gets a little more complicated, clearly. Maybe even the whole universe is a product of consciousness. That consciousness being the consciousness of a great intelligence that thought it into existence. That's my contention. And you don't have to believe that. As I said, if you want to believe that a universe is not really special, it's only part of a huge number of other universes, that's okay. You can believe that if you want to. That's fine.
Now, it would seem to me if what led to us being able to live here should function universe-wide, should it not?
I think the laws of physics and the laws of evolution are probably the same everywhere. And so I'm not arguing that somehow we are the natural outcome of this purpose. Not at all. In fact, I think that we're sort of the accidental outcome, that the intelligence behind the universe made the laws of nature, the age of the universe, and then he let life forms evolve on the surfaces of planets. And the fact that we came out as human beings, that's great. I mean, we can help fulfill the purpose of that intelligence by our very lives, but that doesn't mean we were the purpose. We're the product of evolution. And around some other star, where there's some other planets, they'll have different circumstances. Those, the same laws, but different circumstances, will give you a different outcome. So I think there will be plenty of places in the universe where we have intelligent creatures that are nothing like us, and yet they're the product of the same laws of evolution that we are, just different circumstances.
Well, I've heard all the arguments that we are the end-all, be-all, and I can't buy that. I've heard the arguments that we are the supreme entity in the universe, and I can't buy that one either.
Yep. I wouldn't buy that either. It's a huge universe. I mean, think, for example, of how many stars there are in the universe. Our Milky Way galaxy has about 400 billion stars. 400 billion. There are about 100 billion galaxies in the universe. And our universe may even stretch beyond that, but we'll never know because that's beyond the Hubble horizon. But even within the observable universe, there are 400 billion galaxies with 100 billion stars in each one, roughly. That is a lot of places where life can originate and evolve. A lot.
And there's nothing to say that we're the oldest.
No, in fact, we appear to be slightly on the young side. You do a comparison of stars in our neighborhood of the Milky Way galaxy, you actually find that we're about, I think, somewhere in the neighborhood of a billion years younger than the average. Something like that. And that suggests that if we do find any other civilizations out there, well, they're liable to be a lot more advanced than we are.
Okay, we're finding that you can even communicate with the multiverse. Have you heard, I'm sure you've heard the theory that from every decision, two worlds are created.
Yeah, I have. The multiple universe, many universes approach. Many worlds hypothesis. Frankly, I think that's total baloney. And here's the reason. If every quantum event can split one or more ways, or two or more ways, and every time a split takes place, both of them are actualized, which is the theory, and ask yourself, how many quantum events take place in the universe every second? Now, I don't know the answer to that, but there's something like 10 to the 80th power atoms in the universe, or particles. That's one followed by 80 zeros.
Mm-hmm.
Now, let's assume that each one of those does something every second, which is probably true on average, because inside stars, things happen very rapidly. In intergalactic space, they happen very slowly. But say one quantum event per atom per second. That means that you've got 10 to the 80th new universes springing into existence every second. And the second beyond that, you've got every one of those 10 to the 80th universes birthing another 10 to the 80th universes. I mean, talk about runaway. It's you couldn't keep track of the numbers with the world's largest computer. And so to assume that the universe splits for every quantum event, that takes you into a realm of multiplying universes is just insane. So I frankly don't take that view seriously. I don't take it seriously at all.
Okay. It does seem a little outlandish to think.
It's quite the opposite of Occam's razor. Hammer.
You're right about that. I guess my question about that would be, is it every decision if I decide to turn left instead of right when I walk out of my studio, if I created two universes, or does it need to be a major decision? And if it's a major decision, how do you determine what's major and what's minor?
That's exactly right. I mean, nature is not smart enough to say, that decision mattered, this one didn't. It's either going to be all or nothing, I think, because nature has no way to decide. We don't have any courts sitting there going, well, let's see. He just made his decision to scratch his head. That's major. But over here, well, let's see, the light bulb just blew out. That's minor. So absent any way for some kind of great decision-making process to be built into the system, which I couldn't imagine how it would work, it's got to be every single quantum event. But every single quantum event implies 10 to the 80th quantum events or more per second throughout the universe, and each one of those splitting into a new universe, and each one of those, and each one of those, and each one of those, until it drives you, gives you a headache.
Exactly. Well, physics has always given me a headache. Parallel universes. That's another one I've seen a lot written about.
Well, this is interestingly where quantum, or rather string theory, and let's even say Kabbalah, string theory and Kabbalah would find themselves perfectly compatible. Because in both of them, you have the view that the universe is part of a system that's much greater, that there's more to reality than the physical universe. That's part of Kabbalistic thinking. It's part of most esoteric traditions, in fact, but it's also part of string theory, because we're talking about additional dimensions. And those additional dimensions may number 6 or 7 or 20 or whatever the latest figure is. It varies depending upon the mathematics, but a huge number or a large number of other dimensions. And in those dimensions, there are very likely to be, or there's no reason to think there couldn't be, other universes. And these can be parallel to ours in a very literal sense. It could be an inch away from us in some dimension that we don't sense. So the possibility that there are other universes is inherent in string theory, but it's also inherent in the spiritual traditions of the world. So there's a curious mutual support, again, between spirituality and string theory, which, again, the string theorists would probably not find so amusing.
True. Well, it's the entire concept is one that I find certainly interesting enough to read anything come across. One of our listeners in Peru has an interesting question. What about the prison planet theory? Earth is a penal colony for entities.
Well, it sure seems like that, doesn't it?
Yeah,
read the newspaper.
If that's the case, where do you find the parole board? I want to talk.
Right, exactly.
He says maybe that's why we don't know our purpose of why we're here.
Well, that could be, but I think it's more fundamental than that. I think that if the purpose is for let's just call it God. Let's just stop saying great intelligence. Let's just say God for fun. If God really wants to have experiences, then those experiences are a lot richer if they're not predetermined. But if you come into life, say, and you remember everything you've done before in some past life or past lives, that's a whole lot of baggage you're bringing with you. You're not going to have a fresh start with all that baggage being brought with you. It's just better for the game of life to be played when you start it fresh, like a baby does. When you start out without any I don't want to use the word sins, but transgressions to bring with you, when you're starting out with a clean slate, and where something new and novel can happen, not something pre-planned. I think the essence of living in this physical universe is to experience it brand new, to make your own decisions, not to let God make decisions for you because it's pre-planned, but to live a natural life, to see what develops, to see what happens. I think that's the purpose of it. And so I think there's a reason why we don't remember things, although I admit that it annoys me greatly sometimes to not know why certain of my own characteristics or aspects are what they are, because they may have been something else in a previous life that, you know, I don't remember anymore. I wish I did know, but maybe it's better that I don't. I don't know.
Well, there have been a lot of experiments done. Someone who's deathly afraid of water when regressed to remember a past life, reports being drowned or, you know, something along those lines. It seems that the brain retains the memories if all this past life regression research is valid. It's just there's some barrier that keeps us from remembering it, and you may be absolutely correct in order to allow us to make decisions.
Right, right. I agree with that, and I don't have any memories myself. I have no memories of any past lives, but I do know people that do. And I do know the work of Ian Stevenson, which was a very rigorous 4 decades of research that he did, and several books published. And as I said, that's the evidence that even Carl Sagan said is worth considering.
Well, Sagan was an interesting character in his own right.
He was, yeah. He was a brilliant guy. And his Cosmos series was brilliant, too. But it's brilliant in kind of a limited sense. As inspirational as I found it to be, it showed us what kind of a vast universe there was, what amazing things exist in the universe. But it didn't show us anything cosmic about ourselves. It just kind of put us in the perspective of looking at the cosmos with awe and wonder. What's happened to us when we die? What purpose is there for our lives? It was moot on that point.
That's a good point. It's too bad he died so young.
Yes.
In the, you know, the broad sense of the word. He certainly had a unique way of looking at the universe.
He did, yes. He did some brilliant things. And he's missed.
Of course, now he knows the answers, but...
Yeah. Well, you know, I don't think that in whatever realm we go to, lives, we necessarily know everything. I don't think that the universe opens up to us and tells us everything just because we happen to be in that state. I think that too would take some of the spontaneity out of our existence. I think we're meant to evolve as beings that have to sort of struggle to learn. And so he certainly knows he's still alive in that realm, but I wouldn't say that he necessarily knows everything there is to know just because he's there. And he'll be back.
Yeah, and when if he remembers and tries to convince people he was really Carl Sagan, they're going to lock him up in the rubber room.
Yeah. Well, I hope that the attitudes of people change over the next, well, as soon as possible, but over the next few decades. Because I think it would make a very big difference to the way the world operates. Now, if we really believed that the actions we commit in this lifetime can't be escaped, that we can't dodge the bullet, you know, if we do, that whatever we've done comes back to us in another life, I think that would change human behavior enormously. Now, there are still people who would do things by saying, well, I don't give a hoot, you know, I'm going to look out for myself and do whatever I can to get ahead and damn anybody else for getting in my way.
Mm-hmm.
People would probably still say that, but I bet the number would be a lot smaller. Because if you really believe in your heart of hearts that what you do would come back upon you, if not in this lifetime, in another one. That would be a good moral thermostat.
Well, it would, but as you say, there's so many who would try to get away with it.
They might, but I bet you a lot of people would decide not to get away with it. I think it would have a significant impact on the world.
Well, of course, it would be nice if, I've known some people who were in a position to do some great things and decided to take the easy way, and their entire empire fell apart, where if they had have, at the same time they're professing to be, such upright and moral Christians.
Yeah, that's one of the problems with some of the religions, that there are a lot of claims of being upright and moral. And in fact, when you look at the behavior, it's everything but that. So that is one of the, hypocrisy is one of the problems with religion, certainly.
Oh, if you want to see hypocrisy, go to a small country church. Everybody on the Amen pew ought to be in prison.
I'm glad you said that, not me.
Well, I'm already considered eccentric, so it doesn't, nobody's surprised when I say something like that. Now, I know you've written several books. What's your next one going to be?
Good question. I just recently, just a few days ago, decided, well, maybe I do have a third book in me after all, because when I wrote the first book, The God Theory, I thought, well, I put everything I know into this book. There it is, That's my life's work. And then, sure enough, a few years later, I decided, well, there are a few more things I could say. And I've written this new book, The Purpose Guided Universe, which, by the way, you can go to my website, thegodtheory.com, and find out about them both. I realized there was more I could say, and I developed some of the ideas further in this new book. So I'm not quite sure yet what the third one will be, or whether there will definitely be one. But it'll be, if there is one, it'll be on the same topic, but with a different slant. It's going to be the same thing, of course, because I can't propose a different theory in each book. If I did, you would have to discount me as a liar. I'm trying to talk about universal, timeless truths. There's only so much I can say because, the truth has got to be the truth. But that's a long answer because I don't know.
Well, when I wrote my first one in 1989, I said, my God, I finished a book. I'm not going to do that again.
Yep.
I'm working on my 43rd.
Good grief. Wow, you're busy.
I have something to do. Keeps me out of trouble. More of it.
I guess so, yeah. It does give you something to do, that's for sure.
The I don't believe in PSI. Belief is a matter of faith. I prefer to examine the evidence for PSI. Mm-hmm. Well, there's a lot of people looking for the purpose, and frankly, in some cases, I think the only purpose some people have here is just to annoy me. But some of the questions you discuss in your book certainly raise a series of questions.
Yep.
And, Einstein, I can follow after a fact. Darwin, when he got to a stopping point, just said, well, golly gee, there's got to be a missing link we don't know about. That makes my theory perfect. Well, I got problems with him, too. But unfortunately, I think the missing link will probably always be missing, at least during our lifetime.
Well, we've discovered a lot of hominids. They're very much more ancient than anything that Darwin knew. I believe the oldest hominid now is about 4 million years old. So we've established a reasonably good connection through a line of creatures that are not monkeys, not apes. It's parallel. It's a parallel stream. So there's been a lot of progress in trying to find the missing links over the last, since Darwin, but certainly over the last 30 or 40 years, a lot of finds. So I'm not too pessimistic about that. I think we'll have a pretty good lineage trace. But, it doesn't really matter to me so much what the physical lineage is, because I think ultimately it's the consciousness that chooses to inhabit that body that really matters. That's what really fulfills the purpose of the intelligence behind the universe, is to inhabit this body with a bit of consciousness that is the same as the creator's itself, and then experience reality. So I think it's a great thing to find the physical ancestors of mankind. It's very important. But there's more to it than that. There's at what point does consciousness really become the primary definer of that being? These are questions we haven't even begun to even formulate in a scientific sense, and yet I think they're of tremendous importance.
Well, I think you're right. You know, frankly, I haven't. Well, I guess my main problem with Darwin's theory, if he is correct, and we descended from apes or whatever you want to call them, why isn't that still happening? Why aren't new versions of the human race continually being created, descending from the great apes?
You say why are new versions still being created? I don't understand.
Why are they not continuing to be created?
Well, I think it's a matter of time scales. You know, if we look at human beings in their present form, we go back, what, maybe 20 or 30,000 years, something like that, whereas the major changes that we were just talking about, the different hominids, go back 4 million years. So you're not going to see many physical changes in 20 or 30,000 years, and certainly not within recorded history. So I think it's a matter of the time scale being incompatible.
So you don't hold with aliens coming down and creating a worker race?
Well, you never know, of course, but no, I don't see a whole lot of evidence for that.
Well, that just shot another great theory in the head.
Sorry.
Well, so these speculations, of course, are always interesting when you start delving into the mists of time, so to speak.
Yeah.
Well, I do appreciate you spending an hour with me. It went by rather quickly. In fact, we went just a tad over.
Yes, we did. It was a good conversation.
And the next time you come out with a book, if you'll let me know, we'll get you back on so I can ask you a bunch of new questions.
Very good. That'd be just fine.
Well, I appreciate you being with me, sir.
Thank you very much. Have a good night.
Same to you. Bye-bye. Okay, that was Dr. Bernard Heisch, astrophysicist. He's been an editor with several very prestigious magazines and has written articles for things as varied as Nature magazine as well as some paranormal magazines. When you get into talking about God and science and the universe, you're only one step away from the strange and the unusual. And the Purpose Guided Universe is certainly well worth reading. And you can find it at Barnes & Noble. You can find it on Amazon. Of course, you can go to his website. Now, I've gotten a bunch of emails about shadow people. So I thought I'd talk about them for a little while. Now, certainly it's an area of the paranormal world that you don't see many books on. But in the course of researching my book on secret societies, to my utter surprise, one of the trails of research led me to shadow people. Now, I've had a number of listeners call in and asking me questions about them. One young lady, during her late teen years, opened her eyes one night. She lay in her bed. Just enough moonlight was coming through to so the room wasn't completely dark. The shadow knows. Yes, Chaska is quite correct. And standing on the wall at the head of her bed, looking down at her, was the shadow of what appeared to be an individual. Now, I don't know about you, but that would, if I was half asleep, that'd wake me up in a heartbeat. I've known a number of people who talk to me about their houses being haunted, and the ghosts they describe are actually shifting shadows on the wall, shadows of people. These are the type of things that, especially at dusk on dimly lit rooms, you'll see moving out of the corner of your eye. But when you look directly at them, of course, there's nothing there. They fade into the shadows. Now, in the research, I have discovered a few things about the shadow people I hadn't been aware of. Number one, they're normally shadows of what appear to be men. And quite often they're wearing hats. In fact, the type of hat in most of the descriptions appear to be the fedora. They're usually broader in the shoulders than an average individual. And they're found on the periphery of quite a number of different areas of discussion. For example, the old hag theory. Quite often, prior to the old hag appearing, those who have been visited, if visitation it is, have reported seeing shadowy figures moving in the dimness of the room. Now, for those not familiar with the old hag syndrome, you wake up, normally you're unable to move, and you see this truly ugly woman come into your bedroom, and normally she'll put tremendous pressure on your chest to the point where you almost can't breathe. Now, of course, the psychologists and psychiatrists say it is an hallucination brought on by sleep apnea, which is a condition where you stop breathing during the night. But just as many of those who hear voices may well be psychic and are actually picking up telepathic communications, there may well be something to the old hag syndrome. There may well be entities who prowl the night looking for victims. The Chaska's comment reminds me of, I think it was Bill Cosby, said that his uncle, who had a very deep voice, had the opportunity to try out to be the voice at the beginning of the radio show. And that radio show, of course, was The Shadow. And it was Who Knows What Evil Lurks in the Hearts and Minds of Men, The Shadow Knows. And he went through Who Knows What Evil Lurks in the Hearts and Minds of Men, The Shadow Do. And he didn't get the job. But the shadow, even today, those stories can keep people riveted to the radio. Occasionally, when I would, before or after my show, when I was on another internet network, I would do some of the old shows, because I've got almost all of them on tape. And I'd get complaints if for some reason I didn't play one of them. People just absolutely loved them. Lamont Cranston, The Shadow. The house where the original series was written is haunted. And that haunting actually gives rise to a theory that may explain a lot of paranormal activity. Because the ghost has been seen as a caped figure wearing a broad-brimmed hat. In other words, the ghost that haunts that house looks a great deal like the description of the shadow and the storyline. And the theory that came from that lays out the idea that perhaps all the mental energy that went into the creation of that character and those stories actually gave the character a certain amount of life. Now, if that's true, that could be an explanation for the shadow people. Now, the shadow people are not a new concept. No, no. They've been around for hundreds of years. As far back in history as you care to go, there have been people who react to shadows with fear. You also have to keep in mind that man has always feared the dark. As far back as you care to go, back to the caveman sitting around the fire, they knew there was something out there in the dark. But if they stayed in the light, they were safe. Because whatever was in the dark feared the light. Now, the shadow people are normally just a shadow. Though sometimes they have been seen with red glowing eyes. They don't seem to do anything except just look. But quite often, those who experience their presence report a feeling of malevolence, as if the entity is full of anger and directing it at the person who's being visited. Unlike ghosts, who sometimes pay absolutely no attention to the witness, and these are called residual hauntings when that occurs, the shadow person is always seems to be aware of the witness. Now, like UFOs, they don't come in and cause death and destruction. They just look. Now, there have been a number of theories to explain exactly what they are. One is the fact that they're a ghost, and when you're dealing with the unknown, it's hard to rule anything out, but the characteristics of a haunting don't fit a visitation by the shadow people. There are no cold spots. There are no sounds of footsteps. There's no nothing. In fact, usually a scenario with a shadow person is you're sitting on your couch reading a magazine when something moves in your peripheral vision. You look up, nothing there. You go back to your magazine, but now you're a little more alert to what's to the side. And you see that movement again. You look up and there's nothing there. or you're sitting in, say, your den watching TV, and the door to the hallway is within your field of vision, and something goes past the door, a shadow. You've had a visitation from the shadow people. Now, another theory is that they are time travelers, beings from the future who come back here for whatever reason. Certainly, that would be a potential answer. But time travel, certainly, science has shown time travel is certainly possible. And quantum physics has laid out the how and the why it would work. And there you can demonstrate time travel. You know, the theory is if you have a clock on board a spaceship moving at just below the speed of light, time will pass slower than it does here. When you returned, you would actually be, insofar as this planet is concerned, in the future. And then, of course, they may come from other dimensions. You know, there are three dimensions that we are in, if you will. But it is theorized there are a number of other dimensions. Now, if we're looking at the parallel universe theory, that would certainly raise additional questions. Have I heard of John Titor? There's a book about him. He's supposed to be a time traveler. He, as I recall, he used to do a lot of postings on the internet about the fact that he came from the future. I didn't know there was a book out about him. I've never heard that much about him that he didn't say himself, which, of course, you have to look at as in actuality being self-serving. If someone was from the future, my guess would be they wouldn't be talking about it on the internet, but that's just a guess. I mean, don't you think our government would descend on him with every net they could find? I suspect it would be too much being poked and prodded in laboratories to have time to talk about himself on the internet. But I suppose it's not beyond the realm of possibility. I know close to the end of World War II, the Nazis were doing a lot of research in the field of quantum physics. In fact, they're the ones that really gave it its biggest shot in the arm. And one of their research projects had to do with time travel. And certain people were so sure that it was successful that in the closing days of the war, an SS regiment, which of course was decimated by its field activities, the survivors and their families and all the supplies they could carry went into the underground laboratory where that research was being done and dynamited the entrance behind them, apparently believing that they could use the time travel device the Nazis had developed to go either forward in time or backward in time. Now, had they successfully gone backward into the past, even reduced in number as they were, a cohesive, disciplined SS regiment could probably have changed the past. Suppose something like that was integrated into Napoleon's army. the firepower an SS regiment would have at its disposal would certainly have turned the tide at Waterloo, for example. There was a story I read of a an infantry platoon who went back to the Alamo. And they would have been able to stand off Santa Ana. You know, modern-day weapons against the Mexicans' muzzleloaders would probably have carried today. But just think of all the changes that would have happened had the Alamo not fallen. You know, the very idea of going back into the past raises quite a number of potential paradoxes that could... Suppose you went back into an area where your grandfather lived and through an accident you watched him die. How could you have been born if he died? Prior to the birth of your father. Now, had you caused the accident that killed him, you would never have been born. And because you weren't born, the accident wouldn't have happened. You would have been born, therefore you would have been born, and this would continue over and over and over ad infinitum. Suppose they go into the future. A little bit safer bet there. Now, supposedly, the Allies did not open up that laboratory to see what happened. It's supposedly still sealed off. But if it was opened and there was no one there, I think you'd have fairly substantial proof that they either went forward or backward in time or across time to another universe. The ramifications are staggering, and certainly it would open up an entirely new series of potential disasters. Because you know, if we have time travel, it's going to be controlled by governments. And as governments run out of resources, they're going to go back to the past to get resources. Now, we've talked about time travelers. We've talked about aliens. How about spirit entities? Could they be spirits? Well, a spirit and a ghost can be different. Remember, almost every early religion talked about elementals. These are spirits that never lived in the way that we know life, but certainly they were animated by life force. Well, suppose they interact with us. Eastern religions teaches that there are spirits that interact with us. And a lot of what the Eastern religions teach has turned out to be true. How about astral travelers? There are those, again, Eastern religion teaches that it is possible to travel in astral form, leaving the body. Well, perhaps there are those that are able to see these astral spirits. They certainly wouldn't appear solid. They might appear to be shadows. Now, of course, when you're visited by the shadow people, the very idea that something you can't understand that has just entered your area of control has got to shake you to your core. Now, I had a different idea when I started researching the secret societies. I'm one of those that believes that Sitchin's research is true, that this planet was, in fact, eons ago, visited. And exploited for its resources, because we have vast resources, certainly more than any other planet in the solar system. I mean, water alone, unless the new research that there are underground oceans on Mars is true, we probably have most of the water in the solar system. And carbon-based form life forms, such as we are, do need water. Now, if you've read The Occult Connection, and I recommend everybody run out and buy it. I need the sales. I laid out a theory that UFOs and secret societies and ancient gods were related. They were connected by hidden connections, hence the title Occult Connection, because the word occult simply means hidden. And these hidden connections are what basically drives the world. Now, I think you'd have to live under a rock not to know that there are forces that control society that operate from the shadows. Elected officials are just mouthpieces and front men. I mean, our current administration is a prima facie proof of that. The real powers are those that control the hard assets society need to exist. I point you to the Bilderbergs, the Council on Foreign Relations, the British Roundtable Groups. They are some of the wealthiest, most powerful people on this planet. They're not in government, but they control governments. The CFR has shown its power because Jimmy Carter, Bill Clinton, and Barack Obama were all three endorsed, as it were, by the CFR, and all three came out of nowhere to be elected president. Nobody even knew who the hell Jimmy Carter was before he declared himself for the nomination. Bill Clinton came from a state that was the 50th on any list of anything he wanted to make. But once he was offered membership in the CFR and asked to talk, his election was almost assured. Now, Hillary Clinton is invited to the meetings, but she's never been offered membership, and she's never been invited to speak. And you may say, well, why don't we hear about all this in the media? You would know that there'd be a Pulitzer Prize story involved in all this. Well, if it was written and if it was printed, it might well win a Pulitzer Prize. But among the members are the heads of most of the mainstream media. Almost every anchor is a member. But one of the things they agree to when they accept their membership is they will not talk about it on the air. There will be no reports. There are a number of secret societies where the the powers that be get together. And they'll issue a paper. They'll talk about some issue. And before you know it, whatever position they have adopted becomes the law of the land. Coincidence? I don't think so. Let's talk about the Bohemian Grove in California, where some of the most powerful people on the planet get together to let off steam. They have toga parties. They burn an effigy, which is supposed to be doing away with worry. Now, if any other group of people did things like that, their faces would be plastered all over the local paper and they'd be laughing stocks. But these people control the mechanisms. Now, in the beginning of history, mankind was ruled by kings, kings with ultimate power. And the legends of every society, every civilization, talk about gods who, in the case of the Sumerians, came out of the water to teach them the arts of civilization and went back into the water at night. In South America was Quetzalcoatl, who came around and taught the natives the arts of civilization. And according to the Sumerian tablets and the Egyptian writings as well, the first kings were the gods themselves. Osiris, Set, Anubis. And as the Bible says, the sons of the gods saw the daughters of men were fair and took them to wife. And their children were the great men of old, or as we call them, the demigods. For some reason, the gods themselves withdrew from direct contact with man. If you look at the Old Testament, God was talking to somebody almost every time he turned around. But that changed. And now you have the demigods. Gray artist, well, you might read The Occult Connection, though it has been revised to into a three-book series, one about UFOs, one about secret societies I'm doing now, and the third one is going to be The Ancient Gods. And I discussed The Ancient Gods chapter and verse and show that in all likelihood, the ancient gods were in fact real entities. I mean, the Sumerians talked about the fact that every city had its own god who lived there. And even the ancient Hebrews, during the Exodus, built a large tent, pavilion, for God to live in during that time they were wandering. The first Occult Connection is out. It's called The Occult Connection, Unidentified Flying Objects. This one's called Occult Connection, Secret Societies. And, of course, the next one will be Ancient Gods, which will be out late this year, early next year. Now, there is a lot that I haven't written about yet that I've got material on that will go into great detail, calling into question our view of religious history. But this pavilion that they built, those who were to be the servants of God had to sew bells into the hems of their robes so that they wouldn't sneak up on him unaware. Now let me ask you, if we got an omnipotent God, how could he be snuck up on? Doesn't make any sense to me. But whenever I'd ask that question of, when I was growing up, I was told I just had to have faith. I'd rather know the answers. Now, that's interesting. That explains that. Now, you will find, we're going to be doing something new before this year's out. And I'll be doing a lot of writings in those fields. That will be available for download. Now, Gray Artist says the bells were put in the hymn so that those outside could tell if the priest had been killed. I think you're referring to the once a year when the high priest would enter the sanctum that held the Ark of the Covenant. Because quite often, he who went in the presence of the Ark would be struck down. And it wasn't the bells that in the robes. There would be others watching from outside, and they would have a rope tied around the ankle of the high priest, so if he was struck down, they could drag him from the room. That has nothing to do with what I'm talking about. There was a pavilion built inside the camp each night when the Hebrews would camp, and God would live in that pavilion. And those who would wait upon him would have to have bells sewn in the hems of their robes so that they would sneak up on him unaware. Because if they snuck up on God unaware, he would strike them down. And my question is, how can an omnipotent God be snuck up on? It doesn't make any sense. But The Occult Connection was a fun book to write, and it raised a lot of questions that got a lot of people upset because the old, you just have to have faith, didn't cut it. I had to have answers, and I never got those answers. In fact, when I first wrote it, I put up $1,000 to anybody who could prove anything in the book was wrong. And when I finally withdrew the offer, I still had my $1,000. It was also commanded they go to the bathroom outside the camp because God walked in the camp at night. Well, that's true, and that was just good hygiene as well. There were quite a number of, even the dietary restrictions that were placed on the ancient Hebrews would be those that someone visiting another planet would put into effect to keep from becoming ill, such as no dairy. Even today, if you go into a Jewish restaurant, don't ask for a glass of milk. I watched what happens when that question is asked. We went in New York City, went to it had some of the best hot dogs in the city in New York, but it was a Jewish restaurant. And a young lady came in with her boyfriend and she asked for a glass of milk, and they just literally had a fit. And she said, okay, I'll take chocolate milk instead. Didn't quite get the idea behind it. But the point I'm making is these are dietary requirements that in the long run wouldn't make any sense unless you were trying to avoid local illnesses that perhaps might affect you as a visitor. You didn't have any... Well, we have a nice storm coming. If my system goes down, here in El Paso, if it even looks like it's going to rain, the power goes out. So if that happens, either aliens have hit my tower, lightning has struck nearby and fried my circuits, or if it stays on and you see me fade from the picture, I'm going to get to find out if time travel happens. I'm just saying. Now, of course, going back to the shadow people just for a minute, there have been stories about them as far back as you care to go. Even the ancient Egyptians wrote about spirits of the night. The Egyptians kept records of everything, detailed records. Problem is that sometimes we don't know how to best interpret it. Didn't want to step in it. Well, how could God step in anything? He's God. It would vanish. Hope I don't get a lot of rain like in L.A. El Paso has never had that problem. It used to rain most nights, which kept the place somewhat cool, but in the last few years, there's been a continual drought. But we've had some whoppers of lightning storms. In fact, if you want to go to Mount Taylor, you can watch lightning bolts hit the ground just like they're being aimed. But for the moment, we will continue to with our discussions. Now, the shadow people is an area of continual research, because if in fact we're dealing with those who once controlled the planet, who now rule through others. You know, the demigods, the children of God's immortals, supposedly took the draining oil in Louisiana. Yeah, that's true. The demigods were placed on the thrones of the various empires. For example, the oldest ruling family on the planet at this point in time is that of the Japanese. They can trace their king's lineage or their emperor's lineage back to the mists of time. Supposedly he is the descendant of the sun, the son of the sun, which is what is said about many kings around the planet. You also find that the ruling families, for the most part, were related. In Egypt, of course, the pharaoh was the son of his father and his father's sister. That was considered pure blood. And royal blood needed to stay pure, and that led to a lot of problems such as hemophilia. Many of the European families, even though there were several families, there were a limited number of possible mates, and as a result, you might wind up marrying your cousin or a niece, or someone like that. The end result would be the gene pool would get rather shallow. Even the Tsar of Russia, Nicholas, was actually the cousin of the King of England. And on the one occasion when the Tsar shaved his beard, people were mistaking him for the king. And Tsar Nicholas, the King of England, and the Kaiser of Germany were cousins. The European wars were nothing more than family squabbles. And as long as those families ruled, there was stability. It's when the families were forced to abdicate, which Wilson required at the end of World War I, that everything was set in line. Ah, okay. It's because the families that had kept the stability in place were no longer in positions of command. Throughout history, there appears to be two competing groups. One that does everything in its power to bring about what I guess you can call one world government, and one that does everything in its power to oppose that move. The European family, the royal families of Europe, kept a tight rein on everything that went on within their kingdoms or their empires. And almost every country had its king. Now, some of the royal families, though looked at by the average individual as bigger than life, lost their absolute power. Now, James VI of Scotland, who became James I of England, when he was crowned, in the speech he made, he asserted the divine right of kings, that the king was appointed by God, and if you oppose the king, you are opposing God. And the divine right of kings is not a new concept. In fact, it has been around since the dawn of time. It had its beginnings with the demigods, who were actually the physical sons of gods. Now, over the eons, the power of the royal families waned. Not every heir was a suitable king. Some of them were dumb as bricks. Now, Prince Charles didn't even have a chin. That's why his mother, apparently, won't just step down and let him have a job, because he's not suitable king material. William, on the other hand, seems to have his act together. And he's actually co-ruler with his grandmother. Now, you have to also keep in mind that the British royal family, while held in the greatest of esteem, the country is actually ruled by the Prime Minister. But any move to do away with the royal family would be vehemently opposed by the British people. Look at China. Had a royal family going back thousands of years. The last emperor was eventually died in a re-education camp, as I remember the story. But he had lost, he was so isolated from the people in the Forbidden City that he had lost the rapport that a king should have with his subjects. The Queen of England, on the other hand, is in front of him every day. I knew the ex-wife of the heir to the throne of Greece. And basically they lost the support of the people. And that's why that family was forced to abdicate. The same is true in almost every European country that is ruled by non-royal government. They lost the control of the people. Now, the Communist Party, of course, had a lot to do with that. And yet, even Russia, there's a move afoot to bring back the Romanovs. The family wasn't wiped out. Far from it. There's a large contingent in Canada and here in the U.S. And as we move closer and closer to the one world government that's been talked about so much in the last few years, a lot of things are becoming eminently clear. Number one, that our government no longer cares about the will of the people. Because President Obama has bribed senators to pass bills the American people have said we don't want. And yet, he's determined to pass them. There aren't even bills that will do what he says they're going to do. Now, to have the one world government would require our involvement. And yet, there would be no reason for us to give up our sovereignty. We had a strong economy. We had the largest manufacturing base in the world when Bill Clinton was elected. So what did he do? He passed NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreement. Literally opened the borders. And instead of all the great things he promised, manufacturing went south. Instead of paying $30 an hour, they could pay $30 a month to a worker. And when that, you know, the grass is always greener over the septic tank, and they discovered that the gangs in Mexico, which is where a lot of the companies went to set up their manufacturing base, they wanted a piece of the pie. And when they didn't get it, they started kidnapping officials. So the corporations went to China, where now it's, you know, you can pay a worker, hell, $30 a quarter. You know, the theory behind NAFTA was a good one. If Canada, United States, and Mexico are all working as trading partners, the economies of all three would support each other, but that wasn't what happened. What happened is that the manufacturing base that allowed us to win World War II is no more. And now with all these stimulus programs, the country's all but broke. The only thing that hasn't happened that would certainly be a basis for the UN to come in and literally take over would be civil unrest. And if we're no longer a superpower, then the concept of one world government is all but accomplished. And that brings us right back to the divine right of kings. Now, we've had religious leaders start to suggest that perhaps one world government is the way to solve a lot of our problems. Religion was created as a control mechanism, as I talked to Dr. Heisch. It's been a very strong control mechanism for at least 2,000 years, and I'm sure much longer than that. And those who control, those who literally own everything, sit on the sidelines, sipping their champagne, watching everyone lose everything. You know, sometimes, well, I always heard it said, never be a hero unless the general's watching. Well, these people are sitting back waiting for a disaster that has the entire country, if not the world, waiting with bated breath. And then they step in and say, we can solve your problem. Just elect us president for life. You've already got people wanting Obama to be able to be president as long as he wants to be president. In other words, a king. Right now, we've got so many problems facing us, and nobody seems to have an idea of how to solve them. It's like we're being herded in a certain direction. But if you read the Occult Connection, I think you'll see that what I'm saying is absolutely correct and it makes sense. Now, another question that I was asked in an email today was, is the Amityville horror real or was it fake? Well, I don't think anybody can truthfully answer that question. However, when that house was first built, a family by the name of DeFeo lived in it. A couple, a daughter, and a son. Now, the son was dabbling in the supernatural, as you know, magic and what have you, as many kids do. I know folks I went to school with, bought books of spells at the bookstore and tried to, do the voodoo doll thing where you stick the pen in. And one night, the son seemed to go a little crazy. He shot his parents and his sister in the back of the head with a shotgun as they lay in bed. Now,
a lot of things came out at the trial. Because the son was arrested. And his defense was demonic possession. And a lot of... But the sister kept a diary. And a lot of things that she wrote just sounded downright bizarre. Of course, it came out in the trial that she and he had been, you know, having a fling, and that sometimes he told her sometimes he felt he was possessed by the devil. Eventually, he was convicted because the court wasn't buying the demonic possession defense. House sat empty. It was bought by George Lutz and his family. Now, if you saw the movie or read the book, you know that they were seeing demonic pigs. And they'd see glowing eyes looking in the window. And they had a priest come bless the house. And he wound up literally being thrown out of the house by something. The basement was supposed to be a tremendously haunted area. And eventually, the Lutz family fled during the night, leaving everything behind, to include their clothes. And according to them, whatever had been in that house followed them across three states before they were finally free of its influence. Now, the next family that bought the house had absolutely no problems whatsoever. In fact, they did an interview where there was a secret room in the basement, and the couple that owned the house were photographed sitting in the secret room having a picnic. They said absolutely nothing out of the ordinary had happened. And a lot of people began to believe that the Lutzes had made the whole thing up. Now, the new owners, of course, wouldn't let anybody come in the house to investigate. And eventually it was fenced off, because hundreds and hundreds of cars would park out front, people waiting to see the devil come out the front door and get the paper, I guess. But certainly the stories raised a lot of interest in the supernatural. Now, there have been haunted houses, of course, in almost every town in this country. There's certainly a number of them here. In fact, one of the most prominent is, we have a place here called the MacGuffin House, which was it's a very old home, and it had been in the MacGuffin family until, well, from sometime in the late 1700s. And the MacGuffins were prominent in town. In fact, Joseph MacGuffin was mayor and did a lot of good things for this town. He was a rather portly man, and he also liked ladies, which of course the group that controls that home gets upset every time they hear the story. But it seems that one of his girlfriends was a lady of the evening. And he would go see her every afternoon when he finished his duties as a mayor. And being a gentleman, before he would go home to his wife, he would take a bath. He had bought the young lady a tub, which was a rarity at that time. And he one afternoon he got stuck and he couldn't get out and she couldn't get him out. And they had to call the police to come get the mayor out of the prostitute's bathtub. Well, it embarrassed his wife, of course, and that was something he just... he apparently did love his wife, but he liked the ladies. And, of course, he was wealthy. So he built her a home directly across the street. And legend has it there's a tunnel that runs from somewhere in the gardens of the McGoffin house to that house across the street, even though it's never been found. And there's been street work done between the two houses. Well, his paramour loved to dance, but of course the mayor couldn't take his bimbo dancing. So in that house, he had them build a ballroom. And whenever he had the opportunity to go see her, and let's face it, you know, his wife had to know what was going on. She wasn't a dummy. But apparently, she didn't object strenuously. He would go over and he and she would dance, you know, many evenings. Well, she eventually died. And the house was turned into a an apartment house. There's a lot of those in El Paso. And people would move in and move right back out. And the person that bought it couldn't figure out what the problem was. It was a beautiful house. So finally, he convinced one of them to tell him why they were leaving. Oh, okay. And they said that they would hear the sounds of laughter and music coming out of the area that had been the ballroom. And it was scaring the hell out of everybody. And what made it even worse is the sounds progressed, and then they started hearing the sounds of people actually dancing on the hardwood floor. Well, no one had done their homework, I guess. So no one really knew that what that place had been. But it appeared to be the old man and his young lady dancing away eternity. Now, El Paso, in spite of claims by a number of other cities, is without a doubt the most haunted city in the country. And if you had any doubt of the existence of life after death, you need to come here, because you will discover that there is little doubt that there is something after death. Now, the stories are endless about the strange and unusual things that happen in this town. And certainly there are enough ghosts to go around, but unfortunately we have a number of people who try to own the ghost of this city. And it's unfortunate, because what could be a major drawing card for this town is instead made to look absolutely foolish by the people who try to own it. Now, the next question I was asked was if I would discuss the Aztec underworld. Now, they didn't say what they wanted me to discuss, but to just discuss it. Now the Aztec legends were some of the most interesting, at least those that we know about. The Aztec history was destroyed by the Spanish conquistadors in the name of God. Do I have to split commissions with the ghost? No, they actually seem to enjoy the attention. Now, the Aztec history was almost completely destroyed by the conquistadors, because each of the conquistador groups that came brought their own religious commissars, I guess you could call them, and their philosophy was that the Aztecs were heathen, and anything they had in the way of religion was wrong, and they were all going to go to hell, and it was better that they be put to the sword than forced to endure eternity in hell. In other words, it was the conquistador's way or the highway. And as a result, so much of Aztec history was destroyed, as was the Inca history. Now, the Aztecs had two theories about the underworld. Number one, there was the spiritual underworld, which, as you might guess, had to do with what happens after you die. And then there was a second underworld that, from the few stories, the Spanish were able to to get information on, appeared to be a real place. Now, the Aztec underworld was a place where, according to legend, much of the treasure that they were carrying to the Spanish was hidden after the Spanish murdered their ruler. Now, you can't hide treasure in a spiritual place. So that led a number of people to believe the Aztec underworld was actually a real physical place. But it was never found. Now, there were a number of stories that led people to believe that perhaps the underworld was a place to the north. And there are legends that make it appear very possible that the Aztec underworld is actually a system of caves and caverns and tunnels that many say run beneath the state of New Mexico. And those same myths and legends say that the entrance is actually a cave in the Franklin Mountains, which is right above El Paso. Now, assuming that this is correct, and assuming that entrance can be found, the Aztecs decorated their temples with gold. Gold was not for the common man. Gold was for the gods. So all the gold they found, they dedicated to the gods. And, of course, their ruler was considered a god himself. They had stripped their temples bare in order to ransom their emperor. And no one has any idea just how much gold and silver was on the way to the Aztec capital as ransom. But somehow, when the emperor was executed by the Spanish, word spread, and it spread rapidly. And all that treasure that was en route to Mexico, to what is now Mexico City, which was built on top of the Aztec capital, literally vanished overnight. And search as they might, no one has found any sign of where this massive treasure might have gone to. But if the Aztec underworld is in fact where it was hidden, it does point to a new location and a new possible hiding place for one of the greatest treasures this planet's ever seen. You know, there's so many stories of the unusual that it's hard to it's hard to really figure out which ones are true and which ones are made up. It is also interesting to note that the from time to time there have been stories of prospectors and people of all walks of life stumbling into places where they see items of great wealth. Such is the level of superstition that many times the treasure is left where it's at for fear that the ghost will strike them down for blasphemy. There were missions all across the Southwest, supposedly to spread the word of God, but actually they were looking for gold and silver. And they used the natives that they were supposed to be caring for exploit the wealth. And there are many, many tunnels found and many, many mines found and lost again. The amount of wealth or the amount of hidden treasure in this state is actually beyond calculation. Right here in El Paso itself, there are a number of treasures that any one of which would make you wealthier than Midas. You'd never have to work again. But of course, it's hot, and no one wants to go wandering around in the mountains when you can get a beer and go to the ball game. But you have to ask yourself, what if you could find that treasure? Now, I know a number of people who enjoy treasure hunting. And the amount of treasure, of course, is that they find is not, in most cases, not tremendous. But they have, it's a second income. I also know a number of people who, that's all they do. Now, in each of my Spirit of the Border books, I wrote about lost treasures in whatever area I was writing about. And I wrote about a number of them here. And I've had a number of people come into town just to look for the treasures that I write about. Now, the problem with most folks and treasure hunting is if they found it, they would tell people. It's a feeling of it's a feeling of satisfaction that you were smart enough to find the treasure. But it's that desire to brag that brings you a lot of unwanted guests, so to speak, such as the tax man. Now, nowhere on a tax form is there a place for putting found treasure. There is a place for putting unearned income, and that's what the IRS considers it. Not stopping to think, unless you're a professional treasure hunter, in which case, that's what you do. The wise man who finds a great treasure shuts his mouth, smiles, and goes on about his business. Most folks aren't wise when it comes to treasure. Now, we are going to have some shows about lost treasure. Now, we pretty much cover the gamut of all kinds of things here. And I've had complaints that I shouldn't have authors on to talk about non-paranormal things, but there are many things besides the paranormal. And I have an interest in a lot of things. And then, of course, there are those that say, well, I shouldn't have so many paranormal-related shows. I should talk about other things. So I can't please everybody. But I'm going to try to please as many as I can. Because that's what talk radio is about. And though this is internet-based, it is still talk radio. And no matter what you want to call it, this is a radio broadcast. It's, it is the wave of the future, I guess you could say. and the you know, we've got internet TV, and if you've ever been to the Omega Television Network, I'm on television right now. I've been told that watching me sit here and broadcast is not exciting, but I'm having a good time. Now, before I go any further, I do want to remind you that sponsoring this hour is Golden Corral, 7420 North Mason. A great buffet. The prices are reasonable and the food is excellent. And if you mention you heard about them on the Ken Hudnall Show, they give you 10% off your bill. That's right. Just walk in and say, I heard about you on Ken Hudnall Show. 10% off your bill. Now, Chaska asked if I know much about Mel Fisher's treasure in Key West. You're talking about the Atocha treasure. In fact, I've got a coin from that ship in my collection. The Atocha was one of the big treasure ships, the 1715 treasure fleet. There was so much treasure on board that ship, or in that fleet rather, that the sinking of that treasure fleet sent Europe into a depression that lasted 7 or 8 years. See, the Spanish king, as most rulers were, was in debt. Titles were given in exchange for donations to the country's treasury, which meant putting money in the king's pocket. And nothing has changed today. I'm descended from one of Juan Carlos's ancestors. My ancestor was first cousin to Queen Isabella, not Isabella and Ferdinand, but there was another Queen Isabella. And the firstborn son inherited the title, and my ancestor came to this country as the deputy governor of Spanish America. Well, he fell in love with an Irish girl and got disowned because no relative of the queen would marry an Irish girl. Well, I was at a dinner with, I was introduced to the ambassador from Spain. And we got to talking about family history, and I mentioned that. And he called me a few days later and said he had talked to his government. And if I wanted the title, it would be granted for a small honorarium. And I said, well, what's the small honorarium? And he said, a minor amount. Because the family had died out, so the title was vacant. A mere $100,000 and the title was mine. And I told him I hoped he enjoyed having the title, he could keep it. But if you've ever checked somewhat goes on in Europe, titles are actually for sale. They make great Christmas presents. But the Atocha was a massive treasure ship. Now, Mel Fisher had been searching for it for quite some time. And in fact, one of his sons and daughter-in-laws was killed when the salvage ship they were on capsized one night. And it was in that same general area that they found the treasure. Now, most people picture a treasure ship as being, a galleon sitting on the bottom of the ocean. Well, the teredo worm and that warm water of the Gulf reduces the ship to, I mean, it's like underwater termites. However, what they do find are the cannons and the ballast. And after 300 years underwater, a mountain of gold coins would be covered with sand, coral. They'd be fused together into a ball. Now, items made of solid gold fare somewhat better, but they still get hidden by the action of the wave action. And you need an underwater metal detector, and Fisher and his group were thorough. Now, Fisher was a professional treasure hunter. He had had a chicken farm in the Midwest and got the Kip Wagner and the Real 8 Corporation made headlines back in the late 60s, early 70s with a major find that they did. And Mel Fisher talked with him and saw the treasure, and he got the bug. He got the bug bad. And he dedicated every waking hour to hunting for the treasure he knew would be found. Now, he took in partners because treasure hunting is an expensive proposition. And some of the partners were a little less than, shall we say, honest. And to raise money, they actually counterfeited some of the treasure. And then when it was found out, they tried to blame Wagner. And of course, he pretty well convinced everybody that he wasn't the one that did the counterfeiting. Now, the state of Florida takes a large share of anything found within 3 miles. And everything is put in a room, and Wagner gets to pick, and the state gets to pick, and actually the state gets first pick. And in order to raise money, now he's got a hell of a museum down in Florida. I've never been to it, but people have described it to me. And he took a portion of what he found, and he put it on the market, a coin at a time. Now, you can buy gold coins, and I'm talking about gold clad. I mean solid gold coins. According to Chaska, the ingots found on the Atocha came from Peru, and I do remember that. Has one in a plexiglass box with a hole in it. You put your hand in and you can pick it up with a piece of gold next to it. The ingot was worth about $18,000. They had that same arrangement. They actually came to Las Cruces, which is about 45 miles from here. And they, you could buy the coins. And I got an Atocha coin to go with some other coins that I already had. The problem with a major treasure find like that is every crook that can possibly get there shows up and lays claim. Now, under our legal system, you can sue the Bishop of Boston for bastardy. The only question is, can you collect? And what they do is they file suit and drag you into court, and it costs you a fortune in attorney's fees to defend, so you pay them something to go away. That's known as a nuisance case. And anybody who makes a find of any type will be sued. whether they have a reason for suing you or not, they'll sue. Because unless you want to pay a fortune in attorney's fees, you'll say, look, $10,000, just go away. And normally they take it and go. There's some very unscrupulous people out there. There was a story I heard contractor found some treasure hidden in a house he was renovating. And it wasn't tremendous. It was worth $10,000, $12,000. And his wife told a neighbor who told someone else who told someone else, and pretty soon it was common knowledge he'd found a treasure. Well, a friend of his sued him and said that his grandfather put it in that house. Now, the friend that sued him was related to the judge. So the contractor was facing having to pay thousands in attorney's fees. Because you can't get an attorney worth the powder to blow him up to go to court unless you put five figures in his hand. The friend, and he told about this later when he was drunk one night, he forged some letters that made it appear as if grandfather had, in fact, hid the treasure. So the court made the contractor turn it over. Now, it was theft, but the contractor's problem was he told his wife and his wife told someone else and word got out. And the moment word gets out that you found something, you will be sued. I assure you of that. Because there are more crooks, especially as the economy gets worse, there are more crooks out there than you can imagine. Your best friend will sue you if he thinks he can get the money. Because when it comes right down to it, everybody's out for themselves. Every major invention that has turned out to be a real money-making operation, the inventor has been sued by someone who claimed he invented it first. Eli Whitney invented the cotton gin. Every school student knows that. He didn't make much off of it. He was sued by someone else that said he invented it first and Whitney stole it. So if you find something of tremendous value, smile, go on about your business. You don't need to brag about how brilliant you are at finding the treasure. Because if you do, you're going to wind up in court. There have been cases where even government officials have tried to pull a fast one. In Louisiana, back up in the bayous, there's still some old plantation homes back there that nobody's been near in decades. And a hunter was out there, and he went into one of the old plantation houses, and underneath one of the, they used to have what they called window safes. The frame of the window, the base, would sometimes open up, and there'd be hiding places underneath. And in one of the hiding places, this hunter found a tremendous amount of Confederate money. And he thought it'd be a good conversation piece, so he took a double handful and put it in his coat pocket. And when he got home, the neighborhood gossip was talking to his wife. And when he got out of the car and saw her, he decided he was going to have some fun. So he took that double wad of Confederate money out of his pocket, waved it in the air at his wife and said, "Look what I found out in the swamp." Well, the the gossip took off like a rocket. And the next day, the hunter got a call from the local paper wanting to know about the treasure he found. And he said, "I didn't find any treasure. I don't know what you're talking about." Well, before the day was out, the district attorney showed up wanting to take that treasure into his custody to determine the rightful owner. Well, the law pretty much is settled. That is finders keepers, except in some very limited situations. But that district attorney wouldn't give up. Now, he threatened to get an injunction, and he was going to throw him in jail and drag him into court and take everything he had, and well, he could turn over that money. Well, Hunter said, "I want to think about it tonight. Call me at 9 o'clock tomorrow morning." Well, he had the newspapers there. When the district attorney, instead of calling, showed up with two officers, they'd come to arrest him and confiscate that treasure. And he threw it out on the table in front of the newspaper men and the district attorney. "You're wanting to confiscate Confederate money?" Well, it embarrassed the hell out of the district attorney. I mean, he just saw a chance for some fast, easy money. And that's the case with most people who try to take what someone else has found. Your best way of keeping what you find is don't say anything about it. Okay, we got just a few more minutes left. Now, we got a heck of a storm going on here. But thus far, we haven't had major problems. Now, tomorrow night's guest is M.J. Rose. We're going to be talking about a most interesting book. And, of course, we got Ted Ferrone during the third hour. And if you've got guests you'd like me to get on the show, send me an email. Tell me who you'd like to hear. I just had Kevin Randall last night, who's talking about UFO crashes. I've got Stanton Friedman next month. I've had Jesse Ventura. I've had almost everybody you can imagine. I'm waiting for a call when I can get David Petraeus on. Now, he's not involved with the paranormal, but certainly he's somebody that would be interesting to talk to. I've had generals, I've had everybody you can imagine on this show. And everybody, when they get behind the microphone, is the same. You ask them a question, they're going to give you an answer. Because I don't fly air cover for my guest. And if they get asked a question, I expect that question to be answered. Now, we've got about 2 minutes left. Plenty of time for a question. And I see you all sitting quietly. And that's okay. But it would be nice to have... it used to be when I was on terrestrial radio, I'd get... That three-hour show, I'd get, 30, 40 calls. Now, this is a different method of communication. And a lot of people love to listen, but they don't really like to talk. I understand that. But it's really nice talking with you. And the more people who talk, of course, the more it shows... my guess that people are really listening. Now, we've got statistics show all the various places that this show's heard. We've got about a little over 2 million computers that hook in every night. And a small fraction come into the chat room. A lot of people download the shows the next day and replay them. And we're getting ready to link up with the iTunes store, and we're going to be doing all kinds of new things. And I do thank you all for listening, and we'll be adding some national advertisers who will have giveaways that can be, I don't know about Peru yet, I need an international advertiser. I'll look into that. But we don't need anybody to be left out. But for tonight, we have run out of time. So until tomorrow night at 6, this is Ken Hudnall for the Ken Hudnall Show saying, have a truly great evening. Well, as usual,